are the pirates who don't do anything. We just stay at home and lie around. And if you ask us to do anything, we'll just tell you we don't do anything. We're the pirates who don't do anything. We just stay at home and lie around. And if you ask us to do anything, we'll just tell you we don't do anything.
Well, welcome to the episode 2 on the Pirate Monk Radio podcast. How's that?
That sounds good.
Our engineer is here. He's got moon pies and and probably some kind of energy drink, and we are ready to roll. Are we not?
We are.
What's happening in your world this week? This week at your meeting down there in at Christ Community.
Oh, that was really good. Our Monday night meeting.
Yeah.
At the original Franklin Group, the Samson Society, had a good meeting last week. Our discussion topic, sharing topic was goodness.
Goodness, yeah.
I don't remember having that as a topic before, but it turned out great.
What did you share? Do you remember?
Well, you understand that whatever's said in meetings is held in the strictest
confidence. Yes.
Okay, so I'm not going to talk about what anybody else shared.
Sure.
And maybe not all of what I shared.
All right.
But here's where my thinking was going.
Okay.
In talking about goodness. My understanding of goodness really has undergone a remarkable transformation during the time that I've been in recovery. I know that only God is good. And God's goodness is perfect. And I used to be really perfectionistic myself. So things were either good or awful. Mm. And if there was anything wrong, then they were awful.
Mm.
It only occurred to me recently that evidently is not at all the way God sees things. And what clued me in was the creation narrative in the book of Genesis. It's amazing. Certainly, God has the capacity to create instantly, just as he has the capacity to transform me instantly.
Mm-hmm.
But he chooses to work progressively. It's amazing. Here he is, God, this infinite God, and he creates everything, but he takes his time. So when it starts, when the story opens there in Genesis, apparently there is a pre-existent world. But it's without form and void, and darkness is over the face of the deep. It's a very chaotic scene. And God comes in and says, let there be light, and there's light. And he separates the light from the darkness, right?
Mm-hmm.
So now you can really see the mess a whole lot better.
Mm.
And then he says, it's good.
Mm-hmm.
And he rests. How cool is that? Mm-hmm. Then the next day, you know, he separates the dry land from the water, right? So now you can really see the mess. And he says, that's good. And he rests again. And so we have this story of this kind of this progressive creation. I've really come to understand that recreation happens in the same way.
Yeah.
It's a progressive thing. In the beginning, I mean, just the light comes on and it's ugly and it's, you know, and I want to throw up my hands and say, this is awful. I've got to be fixed and I've got to be fixed immediately and this is terrible. I just can't. And God says, it's good.
Yeah. I get that.
Yeah.
And we talk a lot about how healing or recovery or what have you, you can't see it as an event. You have to see it as a process, as an ongoing thing, or you'll get like lost in the details, you know, and in the push and the pull of like, today I'm having a good day, mm-hmm. and tomorrow I'm having a bad day. So on the good day, God of course is happy with me, and on the bad day he hates my guts.
Yeah.
And when he hates your guts, I mean, that's your last source of hope, and that's been pulled out from underneath you, so you decide to, you know, act out in those mm-hmm. situations too. So that's why it's really important to get that real hold of the goodness of God, the mercy of God, you know, and really understand the gospel as being true, that God is real. He's not Santa Claus. He's not the Easter Bunny. He really is there, and he really did die for your sins once and for all. And that's your past sins, the sins you're doing right now, wherever you are listening to this, and the sins that you will do in the future. Mm-hmm. And if you don't really lay hold of that and believe it, you're going to get caught in that dichotomy on the horns of the altar, just back and forth and back and forth. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, the meetings, when you have your meetings, that would be a typical sort of exchange, right? Just for those, again, who haven't been to a meeting, who
right,
are
yeah.
out there and they're sort of yeah. maybe nervous about coming and going to a meeting.
Right.
Somebody would open the meeting and they'd say, tonight's topic is goodness, and everybody would sort of introduce themselves, and then maybe we'd start with anybody who wants to talk about goodness, go ahead. And you'd say, hi, my name's Nate, and
right.
we'd say, hi, Nate,
right.
and then you would have just shared what
right.
you just shared.
And usually, I mean, I stepped beyond that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's kind of a conceptual thing, but we don't want to have a theological discussion. What we wound up talking about is each guy sharing out of his own story, his own experience, as current as he wants to get,
right?
And about whether that's where goodness fits into his own story,
right? Right. Where all that stuff we were just talking about, how that would actually.
Where the rubber
pertain,
hits the road.
Right where the rubber hits the road. And
right.
so in the interest of strictest confidence, of course, we wouldn't share any of that stuff here. But just so you know, it's just whatever you're comfortable sharing, you know, there. And you can go as deep or as shallow as you want. And but I will tell you that being there and hearing other people really, really share their stuff,
yeah.
as it were, is very compelling. And it makes you want to open up as well. And to lighten the load. And that's sort of the point. Like in the book, it says, you know, when you die, there's going to be six guys who will carry your coffin or how many ever.
Mm-hmm.
And would your wife or your loved one even know how to identify those people? You know, and if they're willing to carry you in death, wouldn't they be willing to carry you in life and carry that burden with you, you know,
yeah.
that you've got going? And that's sort of the point of the whole thing. And you can find groups online in your area. I don't know how many groups. There's 3,000 members at SamsonSociety.org, which probably represent an even greater number of people. And there's groups, I think, from all 50 states are a great part.
Well, we're getting there. We're getting
yeah.
there, yeah.
And so if you want to find a group, a place in your area, just go to www.samsonsociety.org.
Yo, ho, yo, ho, a pirate's life for me. We colors, we plunder, we rival and look, drink up, me heart is your ho. We kidnap and manage and don't give a ho, drink up, me heart is your ho. Yo, ho, yo, ho, a pirate's life for me. We sport, we plunder, we build, we back, drink up, me heart is your ho. Moroccan and metal and even hijack, drink up, me heart is your ho. Yo, ho, yo, ho, a pirate's life for me.
And we're back here at the Pirate Monk Radio Podcast, and this is our second episode, but we are hoping to have many, many more, and in those we're going to actually spotlight some of those groups that you're in and have people who are in those groups call in and tell us what's going on in their areas. We're also going to have some resources, things that we're reading, things that other people are reading that might be helpful for you that we can send to you, or you can find at the website or find links to at the website, or go and find yourself and just sort of resource you that way. But one of the new segments we have is letters from our listeners, and we have a really good one here. Should I just...
Go ahead, David. Yeah. Read the letter.
That
yeah.
sucker. And...
without the identifying information.
Hi, my name's... Oh, wait. Nate, I first saw your I Am Second video several months ago, and it really spoke to me. I'm a lifelong Christian, nice guy who does everything right and who everyone thinks is a great guy on the surface. I'm married and a father of three and have been addicted to lust, porn, whatever, for at least 25 years. God came back and got me, and I am porn and masturbation free since January. I have days of extreme strength and clarity and vision for God's plan for my life. Today is not one of them. I'm coming to terms with what seems like an impossible situation with my wife and our restoration as a couple. Even a slight glance or a struggle with a slight glance is a huge insult to her, and I might as well have just hired a hooker. How does that change? Since I've never been perfect and I always will probably struggle towards purity, how does your wife learn to love and live again? It's a good question. And I think we have a guest today who is going to try to help us at least examine that question and look at it from some different angles. You want to introduce the lovely Hallie Finney here?
Yeah, we are so fortunate to have with us today, live and in the flesh, an actual wife of an admitted fellow struggler here with sexual issues. This is Hallie Finney. 26 years old,
mm-hmm.
Married 5 years.
Yes.
And I'm wondering, Hallie, as you heard that guy's letter, I had some thoughts myself.
Mm-hmm.
What was going through your mind as you thought about this guy and his wife?
Well, my first thoughts and feelings are, you know, it's a very sad situation, and I can certainly relate to how that wife feels.
Mm.
And I can also see the husband's perspective. The first, you know, my husband told me, you know, the first disclosure, I've been struggling with porn. And then, you know, every time he would slip up, he would make a new confession. And every time that he would tell me, he would be free. He would be happy and joyful because he just got this thing off his chest and he's not hiding anymore. But that's when I was at my lowest point, mm-hmm. because he just dumped this thing on me.
Right.
And especially early on, before I started engaging in this recovery process, I had no idea how to handle this.
Yeah.
Up until that point, I'd had a really good life. I never had a struggle that I couldn't read a book and figure out how to deal with.
Yeah.
And this was one thing where I read books and it didn't work. It didn't fix my pain. It didn't go away. And I had no idea what to do.
Mm.
And we couldn't tell anybody.
Ah.
Because of this big shameful secret that we had.
Yeah.
So, completely alone, have no idea what to do. I didn't know how to handle this.
Yeah. Yeah. My perspective, as I really want to get into your story here, but let's turn our attention to the letter quickly, and then I want to dig into Hallie's story.
Sure.
Here's a guy who's been married 25 years. That's a long time. And apparently, so he's been free for a year, and his wife is still with him. So she knows what the deal is, and she has elected to stay, which in itself is remarkable. Not all women choose to do that. There's an awful lot of them who see the door, take the door. This is the last straw. They've lost all hope that it's ever going to be able to, that change is ever going to come, and they're gone. She's stayed. For him, he's got this brand new life. He's got this freedom. He's got clarity he hasn't had in 25 years. Things are coming together. And it's difficult for him to understand how, when he slips, he knows that he's moving in the right direction. So when he lingers too long on a look and she catches him, he doesn't go to despair because he's got some context.
Mm-hmm.
And it's starting to bother him that it's bothering her as much as it is.
Mm-hmm.
And he's wondering, are we ever going to be able to pull out of this tailspin? Is she ever going to be able to trust me again? Is it never? Because I know I'm always going to struggle at some level. Do I have to be perfect in order for her to stay with me?
Mm-hmm.
I have guys ask me a lot, you know, when did your wife begin to trust you again?
We're still working on that.
No, I'm grateful after 11 years in this process to know, to be able to say, really, that for us, the wound is healed. My wife has done a good part of her work. She's joined me on the journey. She knows that I'm not the only one with a problem. God is using this redemptively in my life and in her life. Mm-hmm. She doesn't have perfectionistic expectations of me any longer. She trusts me to my brothers. She knows that I have a vulnerability that I'll have until the day I die. We've elected to see that as God's grace and mercy, that He's allowed it to stay. But I got to tell you, those first the first few months were very, very, very hard. When guys ask me, you know, and during those first few weeks when they start to get freedom and right. their wife is just in the pit. Right. I remember a wife coming and sitting on our porch and looking at my wife and says, I feel like I am the victim of a hit-and-run accident.
Mm. Mm.
And he's doing great and feeling great, and I'm lying in the road dead.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For Allie, I know that that feeling she was a big part of her experience probably for the first couple of years of my recovery. And she didn't have people that she felt comfortable sharing with. She found it very, very difficult to trust me. And when I now step back and look at it from a distance, of course she wasn't quick to trust me. Look at my track record. Mm-hmm. I'd been married to the woman for 20 years. You know, and my big confession is, hey, I've been cheating on you for 20 years. How is she instantly supposed to trust me?
Mm.
She'd seen me turn over so many leaves, make so many attempts at reform, make so many promises that I broke and forgot. How was she supposed to believe that this reform was going to stick? I think her skepticism was natural, normal, and healthy. Her pain was real. And the crazy thing is, it took me a couple of years to realize, to begin really to empathize with the depth of her pain. For one thing, I thought it was all about just the sex, the infidelity. And now that I was being faithful, the pain shouldn't be there anymore. It was interesting to me. It was a mind eye-opening when a few years in, Allie said to me, you know, it's not the infidelity that hurt the most. What hurt the most is the condescension with which you treated me all those years. And she kind of dug below the level of the presenting behavior. And I now understand that I carried that attitude of condescension on into recovery. And really tried to push my wife into recovery. I was going to, you know, I still was the preacher. I just got self-righteous about my repentance. But time and the gospel and patience and humility does bring, I mean, healing comes. I mean, that's our experience. And I see it in the lives of many of my brothers, those whose marriages have survived. Not all have. But guys who are fortunate enough to be married to godly women who recognize the gospel, and the Spirit of God continues to kind of apply the gospel to our experience, break through our walls of denial. Healing is gradual. Creation was a progressive thing. Recreation is a progressive thing. But the whole process is good.
Yeah.
And what we have to do is guard against, as you were saying, Doug, we have to guard against the temptation on the day when it's bad. My wife was still having bad days 3, 4, 5 years into recovery, which would demoralize me. We'd have this wonderful weekend, and we're close, and we're intimate, and I'm thinking, we're back! And then something would remind her of the pain. And all of a sudden, it seemed like emotionally we were back there again.
Yeah.
That was part of the process.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it just reminds me again of that book we were talking about last week. Gary Thomas, Sacred Marriage.
Yeah.
Where the idea is that maybe marriage is more about being holy than it is about being happy. And so maybe God actually chooses the person with the type of struggles that they have in their own walk and puts them in your marriage and puts you two together and then sees what's going to come out. It's like putting two cats in a bag and seeing who comes out alive. So in your case, like, the wife, she shouldn't trust you. Mm-hmm. You're not trustworthy.
Right.
But you have to learn to actually be a trustworthy, faithful person, right. You know? And that really is a process. You don't just become that way.
Yeah.
And if you are the person that you think you are on your weekdays and that God can't, like, go beyond that, that his strength isn't enough to, like, you know, carry through on the weekdays, then he's a very weak God, and that's not the God we serve, I don't believe, you know?
Yeah.
And then on the other tip, like, many times the wife, she has, like, her own issues that she needs worked out of her, like, sometimes it's a legalistic bend. Sometimes it's, not having trust at all of anybody in any situation, you know. Mm-hmm.
This may hit an old pain, an old wound.
That God says,
abused, yeah.
I choose to work that out of you because you're worth it. You know what I mean? You're worth working it out of. So he, like, puts you with this person. That, and I'm not saying it's not any less painful. I'm just saying, what if we looked at it like that rather than, you came into this marriage and you brought this into our marriage? How could you? And God is sitting back and wondering whether you'll try to find a book to fix it, you know, and try to fix it yourself, whether you'll find the door and fix it that way and just leave, or whether you'll stay and actually let him do what he says the gospel is meant to do, which is recreate this relationship, you know. Let's take a break here at Pirate Monk Radio, and we'll be right back.
Because I'm addicted, I'm needy, I'm lost without you. I need you, I need you.
Amazing grace.
We're back at the second episode. We had our inaugural podcast last week, and Mondo loves the way I say inaugural. And look, I'm Southern. I'm not slow. I'm deliberate. Okay. But really blessed today to have a guest with us who's going to share with us based on the letter that was sent in this week from another listener from another part of the country, wanting to know what you do when your wife is having a hard time. You've disclosed. You're feeling great. You've lifted the burden. She's been hit by an atomic bomb. We have Hallie Fanning with us this morning, and Hallie, we just want you to just start where you want to start and tell us your story.
All right. Well, thanks, guys, for having me on and giving me this opportunity to share my story. My husband, Michael, and I have been married for 5 years now, and we had a great marriage. We had, you know, everybody thought we had a great marriage. We thought we had a great marriage. Everything was working fine. You know, we had the typical usual fights, and we just thought it was normal.
Mm-hmm.
We moved to Nashville from our hometown in the early spring of 2007. And so a few months later, in July of 2007, we'd only been here a few months, struggling to make friends, struggling to find a church home. You know, I was still looking for a job. And, you know, we're completely alone and stripped of all of our resources and everything that we're familiar with. And in mid-July, my husband decides to tell me that he's been struggling with pornography, and he wants it out of his life. And I had no idea that was coming. I had no idea what to do with that. The first thing that I said to him was, "I forgive you," because I was a good Christian girl, and that's what you're supposed to do.
Mm.
Of course, I'm just been dropped, like you said, this atomic bomb, and so I felt nothing. So I did what I was supposed to do, and that's say I forgive you. And we ordered some books on from the internet and read those and said a few prayers for a few weeks and then never talked about it again. Because it was supposed to go away, because we fixed it. So it should be no surprise that the following July, when we're approaching this horrible date that he told me last year, you know, we're approaching and getting ready to celebrate his 1 year of being free from this thing, we were having a discussion about it, and I looked at him and I said, don't make a fool out of me, and let me celebrate this, and you being free from this if you're not. And so he sat me down and he said, we need to talk. And he said that he had been slipping up some more during that year. And so we spent from July of 2008 until November of that year pretty much falling apart completely. It was a really rough time. In August, we took a marriage class that was really intense, very homework intensive. It was supposed to fix us. And it did not fix us, but looking back, we can see how that really prepared us for what we were about to go through. And it was a really sweet gift from the Lord, because it kind of unified us and solidified us for the journey the Lord was about to take us on, and we needed that. So that was good. But between July and November, Michael continued to slip up, have just different times of looking at porn and messing up, and he would tell me pretty immediately, you know, I slipped up again. And it was in November when he went on a trip out of town with some of his friends, and I was scared to death to let him go. I hated it when he went out of town anyway, and so, and that was before I even knew about this thing in his life. And so he was not supposed to have a room by himself, and he was not supposed to have internet access. Well, he gets there, and he has a room by himself, and he has internet access. So he starts feeling pretty lonely one night, and he goes out on the internet and finds some porn, and then he actually calls me the next day. I had gone back to our hometown to visit with my family, and he calls me and tells me I slipped up again last night, and that was pretty much it for me. I told him, I don't want you to come home. And I told him, if you do come home, I'm not coming home. So, that was actually one of the most horrible moments of my life. That was a horrible day. Our parents had no idea what was going on, so here I am with my family trying to pretend like everything's okay. And we actually did work it out a little bit to where he did come home and I went home, and that was a huge wake-up for us when we were both, you know, when I said, I don't want you to come home, that was a wake-up for both of us that we got to do something about this. So, he decided that he would start attending a support group that he found at our church for men dealing with stuff like this. And so he started doing that and started finding some help for himself. And so I went to find some help for him, too. someone to help me help him.
Yeah.
And so it was actually kind of hard to find where I was supposed to go, because my husband didn't want me to tell anybody, and I didn't really want to tell anybody either what we were dealing with. So I did find a support group that was meeting at our church, but I had a full-time job at the time. It met during the day, so I just emailed the leader at the time and said, you know, I need something, and here's the hours that I'm free, and can you tell me of a group that meets then? And she actually started meeting with me on a weekly basis and just walking with me through this, because she'd walked down this road before. And I didn't get too far into it before I started realizing, and before this woman who was walking with me started teaching me, that my husband had this battle with lust and pornography, but I was going to have a battle all my own. And I did have a problem all my own. And my battle was with, first of all, trying to manage him and his recovery process and trying to do that for him and help him along. But my real battle was with codependency. And basically, that was this weird word that took me months to understand what it meant and what it looks like. And I just really had to wrestle with the Lord and with this precious woman who was walking with me, who told me week after week, this is what it is, and this is, there it is again in your life, and that sort of thing. And slowly, the Lord got through my stubborn heart, and I began to see that I was completely codependent on my husband. And basically what that means is I made him my everything. He was responsible for my emotional happiness. If I was angry, especially if he's the one that made me angry, he was supposed to fix it. And he had to jump through these hoops and do this stuff to fix it. If I was lonely, lonely was the big thing. I hated feeling loneliness, and all that goes way back through my whole history. Hated feeling lonely, so whenever I felt lonely, he had to fix that. And I had made this secret vow that I didn't even realize I had made, that, you know, when I got married, my husband was going to be this great religious man. He was going to be godly. We were going to read the Bible to our kids. We were going to serve and follow Christ, and I wasn't going to have a problem in the world, and he was going to, you know, we were going to be happy all the time. And, you know, this whole porn issue kind of shattered that. And so, as I started to realize just how much I had made Michael responsible for me, for myself, for taking care of me, you know, I started to see that he wasn't the only one with the issue that needed to work through. So we both started seeing a counselor, and started diving into what was really going on behind both of our stuff.
Yeah. Coming to grips with life in a fallen world. You guys hadn't escaped the fall.
No. We thought we had.
Yeah.
We lived in this complete world of denial. I really wanted to believe that, you know, I didn't even know I was in denial. I guess that's the essence of denial, but, you know, life is hard, and we feel hurt, and we feel lonely and sad, and there are things to get angry about, there's things to be ashamed about, we feel guilty. I didn't want to feel those things, so I just shut my heart down. And every time my heart roared back up and said, you're feeling hurt or something, I would run to somebody or something, in this case it was my husband a lot, to fix that. He had to fix that.
So now, at this stage in the journey, and we know the journey continues, it sounds to me as though you and Michael are agreed that this is it's a good journey to be on together.
It was a good journey to be on together. It was very hard. This is the hardest year of my life this past year. But it's been the best year.
Yeah.
It was, and you said it's a good journey to be on together. We were on it together, but a lot of both of our journeys, but a lot of my journey was separating. I had become completely enmeshed with him. There was no me. I had no feelings. I had no opinions. I was doing anything I could do to not feel lonely. And I was constantly on the lookout for Michael emotionally abandoning me.
I was,
you can imagine the kind of wife I was. I was, you know, even though I looked good and everything, I was controlling and manipulative and, you know, very demanding. And Michael was always walking on eggshells. He was very passive. He was very withdrawn. Part of that was his story. Part of that was because, you know, I'm this this person who's making him responsible for my emotions and everything. So part of my journey was actually separating from him. And I had this vision. I like a literal vision, but I could kind of see as we were walking. It felt like there's this river in between us, and we just kind of had to separate. And he was walking down this side of the river, and I was walking on the other side. And it was terrifying to me to let him go, to feel that lonely, to finally feel lonely.
Yeah.
And not know. You know, I knew Jesus. We both did. And I knew the hope of the Lord and that sort of thing. But to sit there, to let him go, to feel lonely.
Yeah.
It's terrifying. And especially to let him go and not manage his battle.
Right.
To not make sure that he wasn't looking at porn or doing worse than he just hadn't told me yet.
Yeah.
You know, to open myself up to that kind of pain again is terrifying. And I could not have done it alone.
Yeah.
Without these people that were walking with me.
So you needed community.
Yeah. And I hated that.
Well, you know, the world tells us, and Hollywood tells us, that you don't need community. You just need to find the perfect person. Are you telling me that's not true?
Well, I did that. I found the perfect person. And then he blew me up. You know, I really thought I'd found it with Michael. He was supposed to be the one, and that's part of what made this so painful. Because it's like, well, what do I do now? You were it.
Yeah.
You were supposed to fix everything.
I really resonate with your story of individuation, because that is my story and Allie's story, our marriage story as well. We were so enmeshed before recovery. And now we've become separate individuals. But strangely, we're closer than we ever were before.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mm. But I've come to understand that that, too, that enmeshment is, at least for her, is a consequence of the fall. The Bible makes it clear. You know, that in the beginning, husband and wife had this intimacy with each other and with God. And together they walked with Him together on a daily basis.
Right.
And then they decided that they wanted to know what was good and what was evil. And so they ate from the forbidden tree, right? And that brought about this turning. And the Bible has this strange way of describing the consequence of the fall. Here's a man who was formed by God out of the dust of the earth, and a woman who was formed by God out of man. And after the fall, they turn from God. She turns from God, but not from relationship. She turns to Him, her proximate source, the man, the place from which God had brought her. And she said to the man, "You'll be my source."
Mm-hmm.
And the man turned from relationship altogether to the ground from which he'd been made.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, you'll be my source, my work.
My work.
Yeah. Well, this is deep stuff, wonderful stuff. The phenomenal thing to me is how lonely we addicts feel. We have this sense of terminal uniqueness. I'm in a struggle that nobody else has. And how isolated most couples who are in this recovery process are in the beginning of the process.
Right.
You just feel completely alone.
Right.
Can't tell anybody. And yet you're telling me that relationship was key to progress for you.
Absolutely.
Any suggestions for husbands and wives out there who are in the beginning? There's been disclosure. There's tons of pain. There's tons of pressure in the house. From day to day, they lose hope that they're ever going to be able to see the thing through. Mm-hmm. Any advice you'd give?
Well, the advice I'll give is the advice that we followed, which was, you know, I don't know how, but we found some safe people. My advice would be to find some safe people. You can't do this alone. The husband and the wife can't do this alone. And so finding a safe person to talk to, whether that's a counselor or a pastor or someone in a support group or something like that, some safe place. And the husband needs to go to his group and deal with his stuff. And for me as a wife, I needed a place where I could go and I could grieve.
Mm-hmm.
And I could not husband bash, but I could be honest about the hurts that I'd experienced. And someone could say, yeah, I know that sucks.
Yeah.
Yep.
Not fix it, but just let me grieve. And another place where I could also be confronted with my issues and the things that I had done wrong,
mm-hmm.
which is really hard, you know, when we're this hurt, to admit that we've done things wrong.
Yeah.
Too. So finding a safe person. And an example of a not safe person would be like our bitter divorced friends or, you know, someone who's just, well, you need to get out of there. You know, maybe this is a situation where the marriage doesn't need to work or not. I don't know. But you can tell when the person's not safe and when the person is just emotionally invested in fixing you instead of letting you grieve and process out your feelings. That's probably not the best person to find support from.
Mm. Wow. Good direction. Question, Hallie. If listeners would like to communicate with you directly, if they were to send a letter to samsonsociety.org, would it be okay for us to forward those letters to you?
Certainly.
Okay.
Certainly.
So certainly there's... out there somewhere, a few women who are listening to this podcast and are like going, And they're doing it surreptitiously because they don't want anybody to know they have this grand secret hidden away, just as you did. And we would encourage you and others, if you want to get in touch with Hallie Finney, to just write write us here at letters@samsonsociety.org, and in the maybe in the subject line, just put Hallie Finney, and we'll forward those on to her and try to get her answers back to you. And you're listening to the Samson Society podcast on the Pirate Monk podcast.
Oh, a pirate's life is a wonderful life, a roving over the sea. Give me a career as a buccaneer, it's the life of a pirate for me. Oh, the life of a pirate for me.
We're back at the Pirate Monk Radio podcast for SamsonSociety.org, and Hallie's story was nailing me as I was just sharing off mic. And I mean, there's some ways in which I relate to her husband, and there's a lot more ways that I relate to you as a woman, because like a lot of my stuff is definitely dependent on how my wife, her emotions, how she acts or treats me, or the looks she may give that may mean nothing, can destroy me, you know. And and that's my battle and my work that I'm doing. And but I think probably the most significant thing that she said to during her testimony time, as it were, hallelujah, was the fact that you have to have a safe place. Mm-hmm. And even as she was describing that, she's having a hard time describing exactly what a safe place is, because it's so elusive.
Yeah.
And you and I taught a whole 12-week Sunday school course of study on what a safe place looks like and what it is and why this isn't it. And so it's understandably a hard thing to pin down, but I can tell you that 90% of the people in the world are not a safe place, you know. And
yeah.
Maybe you could, like, just elucidate, my friend.
Well, I think that's part of the challenge, is to build a safe place. It's unfortunate that most churches, most evangelical churches in America, are not safe. Too deeply invested in fixing people. We've eaten from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil.
Mm.
We actually think it's our job to judge. And that marks the boundary between us and God. God can judge because he's omniscient. Our job is to love. And we tend to be pretty poor at loving.
Mm.
Until we faced our own brokenness, somehow when we've tasted mercy, it's easy for us. It becomes easier for us to give mercy. And so the safest people are the broken people.
Mm-hmm.
I'm grateful that I found the first safe place I found was a 12-step recovery group.
Mm.
So my advice is find the broken people. Find the messed up people.
Mm-hmm.
They tend to be the safe ones. And I'm praying that God, you know, Samson Society is a safe place for guys, and we see it growing. But wherever I go, when I travel around the country, when we open up for questions, invariably, almost invariably, the first question is about wives.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about your wife, Nate. Talk to me about my wife. What can I do for my wife? What can I get heartbreaking letters from women. And one of my great prayers is that God will form, alongside this safe community for men, a safe community for women who are impacted by this epidemic of illicit sexual behavior.
Mm-hmm. Make no mistake, I mean, it is an epidemic. And that's the thing. It's like we let ourselves get boiled like a frog, you know, slowly by degrees, and now here we are. And so what are we going to do, you know? Books are not going to fix the problem. If fleeing out the door is not an option, than brotherhood, or in this case, sisterhood.
Yeah.
Maybe a Samson sisterhood.
There you go.
And I think that I think for me, just having a safe place helps you then be able to discover new safe places and easier.
Yeah.
More easily define where those are, what they are, and where they are. Like even in this room right now, if we shut off the mic, I would feel completely comfortable,
right?
Like sharing my story, you
yeah.
know what I mean? And because I know it's safe in this
yeah.
room at this time, and I don't even know you know,
yeah.
Hallie. I don't know Hallie,
mm-hmm.
and I would feel very comfortable with that, and so what is it that it's like? I know these other people for, you know, 20 years, but you know, if you go there with them, then
yeah.
You know, it's any number of things, from sharing outright to like being ostracized, to all kinds of things, you
yeah.
know. And
I've found that it is possible under some conditions, at least, to create a safe place.
Mm-hmm.
Be a safe person and you create a safe place. I find that when I share my story honestly and openly, now that I'm able to do it without fear and without shame,
mm-hmm.
that does make it safe for other people to share their story, and now we've got a container. And I really believe, Hallie, that your courage, and I want to thank Michael, because I know you did not share your story today without talking about it, praying about it with Michael, and
right.
without his encouragement to do so.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very courageous thing to do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So thank you, Michael.
Yeah. I want to believe that your willingness to share your story this openly and in this much detail is going to go a long way toward creating safe places for other women, giving them the courage to do
mm-hmm.
the same where they live. Thank you, Hal.
Thanks so much.
Thank
and stories. Stories are what really what make identify many times these safe places. And my story is different from your story. Nate's is different than mine. Hallie's is different from mine. And Michael's is different from mine. And I think once we see that other people are broken in different ways, or even in the same way a lot of times, and that they're willing to share it, as you said, go looking for the broken people, and that's where you're going to find safe places. And in the spirit of that, I'd like to encourage you to write us here at the Samson Society at letters@samsonsociety.org, and give us permission, if you would, in the letter itself to read those on the podcast, and we'd love to share your stories with other people so that they can be encouraged that they're not alone, or be encouraged that they're not as bad as you are. No, not really, but but we want to share stories. We want to hear those stories coming in, and it really does encourage us that you're out there hearing what we're saying, and that and we'd like to hear stories of where you're overcoming and where you're not, your confusion, your questions. Please send all that stuff to letters@samsonsociety.org. And you've been listening to the Pirate Radio Podcast, actually the Pirate Monk Radio Podcast, here at Samson Society.
We are the pirates who don't do anything.